just the other day. He came to the world in the usual way, but there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away, and he was talking for I knew it. And as he grew, he'd say, I'm gonna be like you, Dad. You know I'm gonna be like you. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home.
Welcome to It's About Time. Today we're going to be talking about how to create more leisure time in our lives. And our guest is Kathy O'Keefe. Kathy has a master's degree in therapeutic recreation, and she's a professor of leisure theory at the University of South Alabama. Kathy is a frequent speaker at local, state, regional, and national conferences. Her and her husband, Dennis, have 5 children. Welcome to the show, Kathy. So, Kathy, we're going to start with talking about what is leisure time. Maybe 20 or 30 years ago, we meant something different by it than we do today.
Right. Leisure comes from the Latin word licere, which means freedom. And what leisure really is the freedom to become your true self. Now, over time, we've morphed it into simple definitions like leisure is time. Leisure is activity. Or leisure is a state of mind that you want to achieve when you are doing activity in your free time. But really, it's a combination of all of those. So when we talk about our leisure, we're really talking about the freedom to become your true self. I can have 3 hours to myself, but it doesn't mean that I'm going to engage in leisure. Even if what I do is activity that I truly want to do, like working out.
Mm-hmm.
If working out isn't on my list of things that I really love, they help me become my true self, I'm not going to perceive it as leisure. So it's all in the mind, and the specialists on this topic tell us that there are 4 attributes of real leisure. One is you have to perceive that it's free. You've freely chosen to do it. You have choices. Another is that you perceive you have some competence at it. Because that's important, to feel that you can do whatever it is that you want to do, even if it's doing nothing. Some people don't do nothing well. Another is a sense of self-efficacy, or that you are in control of your own destiny enough that you have the power to be in charge of your own happiness. And the 4th is intrinsic motivation, and that means that we do it because we love it, not because we're getting a trophy or we're getting paid or some external person is affirming us. We just want to do it because we enjoy it.
Uh-huh. Now, I always thought that leisure was the opposite of work. And what if your truest self is a hard, long hours worker, you know?
Oh, you went right to the heart of the issue. When I taught leisure and work to a class, I asked them to tell me what they wanted from their job. These were midlife people who were changing careers because they were unhappy. Guess what the first thing they put up? We want to feel we have some choice and control. Then they said, we want to feel like we do it even if we didn't get paid. That's how much we love what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to feel competent at it. Well, of course, what they were doing was putting up the attributes of leisure.
Oh.
So ironically, the ideal world is the world that Robert Frost describes in his poem, "Ah, that my vocation and my avocation were the same."
Mm.
Oh, that I love so much my work that it feels like leisure, or oh, how lucky I am that I'm getting paid to do what I love and what I would do just as a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
So occasionally we find people who hit that wonderful happy medium where work and leisure are seamless and they blend together and they provide the same kinds of satisfaction and energy, under both titles. It's just that not many of us get that.
Right.
And that's why only you can determine where you're crossing the line into unhealthy work and where you are getting enough of the healthy leisure. It's an individually determined definition.
Uh-huh. Now, is it true that we take less of our time for leisure than in years past?
Yeah, there's been some contrasting studies on it, but I really do think most of them come down on the side of diminishing time, certainly, for leisure. We had a lot of great time-saving devices that came out in the 50s, you know, washing machines and all these things that were supposed to free us up and give us more leisure. But what we did instead, and commercialization is largely to blame for this, we ratcheted up the standards for cleanliness. Wow. Now it wasn't enough to wash your clothes once a month. Now you have to wash them every time you wear them. You know, it wasn't enough to do spring house cleaning and fall house cleaning. Oh, my God, now you have to be able to eat off your floors. They're so clean. So all we did, we exchanged these wonderful time-saving devices for a higher standard of cleanliness or work. The work has to be perfect. Now it has to be in the right fonts. It's got to be presented in colorful, you know, format. We're taking even PowerPoint to the next level. It has to be animated. So you can't just get your work done now. It has to look great.
Right. I was wondering if that was true with all this, with computers and email, if that also, I thought the idea was to save us some time and give us some more leisure time.
That's right. And sadly, it's just meant that we can now take our work home with us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for some people who have just craved more flexibility, they don't mind taking their work home if they can put it down and go take an hour and read to their children before bed. You know, or they can go take a run in the park and then come back to their work. That can be actually nice. But if you are on call, and you have to drop whatever you're doing. You've got to put down that book with your daughter. You've got to stay at home waiting for that call to come in, and you can't go take a run. Well, then the technology isn't working for you. It's working against you.
Right, right. So this isn't really a matter of being better at time management.
No.
No.
No, it's not a quantity of time, but I want to say this, because do you remember when we started saying, oh, yeah, mothers should go to work, because it's not the time we spend with our children, it's the quality time we spend with our children, as if we could somehow dictate, okay, going to be quality time now for the next 30 minutes. You're going to have my full attention, and I'm going to have your full attention. It doesn't work like that. Anybody who's had kids knows it doesn't work like that.
Right.
You have windows. Your children present you with windows, and our experiences present us with windows where wonderful things happen in relationships with children, with lovers, with spouses, with, you know, everybody, coworkers. And you've got to be available to take advantage of those times, those windows that create memories and deepen our relationships and give us intimacy and all that stuff. You can't order that up. So the problem with the time thing is that if we are so engaged in constraints to our time and so burdened by barriers, we don't have control over it. It wouldn't matter how many hours a day we had.
Right.
We don't have control over it. And that's what's so sad about what's happening today. No wonder people are talking about multitasking. Oh, well, I'll just solve this problem by being able to do four things at once. I'll type on my computer while I listen to you on the phone, and I'll eat my lunch, and I'll answer the door. How nuts is that? So, but people are thinking that that's what they're supposed to be doing to cope with this problem.
Right.
We'll just ratchet up.
Raise
the
standards,
right.
Keep raising them.
Right.
So how it feels like it's such a strong cultural push that in order to do it differently, you have to really, I almost have this image of like turning around to all this pressure and just saying, I'm not going to do it that way. But what does it take to do it differently?
Well, first of all, we actually haven't been this way as long as it feels like we've been this way. Most of these really great time-saving devices came in my lifetime, and I'm 56. So before that, before television, you know, people did have chance to sit around in the evening and do things. And to tell you the truth, if you're thinking about time in the bigger picture, before electricity, we had a whole different world. Once electricity came and you could operate factories 24/7, you could keep your lights on at your home 24/7 without reducing your candle collection and all that, then everything changed after that.
Right.
So we're only talking about, you know, a recent relative period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you just take, the last 65 or 80 years, something like that around there, we have ratcheted up so rapidly that I think it's going to take an equal amount of grassroots breaks to put the skids on this trend and for people to say, enough is enough. We've got to have some balance here. We've got to attend better to our life work needs. And otherwise, as John DeGraff says, what's the economy for?
Right.
If we improve our productivity as a nation and we make all these wonderful things available to people, but they have no time to do them.
Or to enjoy them.
Or to enjoy them, then what's the difference? And
right.
I don't know if you've noticed this, but if you open your paper during the week to that section that lists all the wonderful things that there are to do in your community, I look at that and I say, geez, I'd like to go to that. I'd like to go to that. I'd like to go to that. I'm so tired. I think I'll just go home and put my feet up. Well, that's so sad. So there are wonderful things for people to do, but people are so overtired by the end of the day that disengaging, sadly, for many, means just doing nothing.
Right.
So anytime you force people into one extreme, it takes an equal force of opposite extreme to create the balance.
Right. And, you know, what you're talking about is what all these choices in our lives take so much time and energy to weed through.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes, like you said, you don't even want to engage in making the choices.
Sure.
Or it's just too much. And a lot of it, I feel like, is a matter of letting go of, I can only do so much in my life. There's so much offered to us, which is so wonderful. And like you said, in your community, you know, there's all these offerings, but you have to decide at some point, I can't do everything.
Right. That's right. In order to be a creative person, you have to have time for awe and wonder.
Right.
And awe and wonder, again, are one of those serendipitous things that happen, like those windows I was describing about quality time. You can't manufacture them. It's in the process of ordinary looking that you spot the sacred.
Right.
And I really would encourage your audience to just think about how they want their life to be, and to live more intentionally. I don't know about you, but I think most of us just sort of get swept along in this tide of culture.
Right.
And we take a job, and it looks like a good job, so we do it. Oops, it's an hour commute. Oh, well, I'll handle that. And then, you know, we get married, and we have our requisite couple of kids, and oops, they're taking a whole lot more time than I thought. Okay, well, I'll just get child care, and I'll, you know. Instead of sitting and saying, as I do to my students in college, why don't you start thinking now about where you want to live? Do you want to live in a walkable community? Do you want to live in the suburbs where you have to drive everywhere? Do you want to live in the countryside? What kind of job do you want? Do you want a 9-to-5 job? Do you want a job that is 24/7? Do you want a job that's, you know, and then you start this process of living more intentionally. And then I say to my students, you know, where is your free time? And that's no wonder what they're doing. If by the end of the week, after they've overdone it on one end, no wonder they're binge drinking.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So anytime you see extreme leisure use in extremes, like excessive drinking or even excessive working out, I mean, you know, we know that there are things, there's something called exercise bulimia, where, and high school kids are prone to this. They work out until it's too much. Excessive dieting, you know, anything, excessive shopping.
They're all reactions to the stress of...
They're all the reactions. They're the excessive reaction to the excessive overload that people feel on the other end, which is why it's all about moderation. Now, do I sound like a pilgrim? Do I sound like a Puritan? And honestly, the Puritans weren't as anti-leisure as we often think they were. They were just for balancing work and leisure and not doing things to extremes. Some of them were extremists, but most were not.
So how do we balance? What are some ideas and ways? Because I know that I think of myself as living intentionally, yet sometimes I feel like I don't have control over how my days are spent and what I'm doing. And so I would love to hear some ways that we can become a little more moderate.
Right. Well, I think one of the things, and psychologists talk about this today, is emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence is, first of all, self-awareness, knowing what it is that you're feeling, knowing where that feeling is coming from, and knowing what's the right intensity of response to that feeling. Now, little kids are supposed to learn that. What I just named you are the three affective developmental milestones or emotional developmental milestones that we should be teaching little kids. How do I feel? Where is that feeling coming from? And what's the appropriate intensity of response? Once you get to be an adult, that should be second nature to you. You should know when you're stressed out. Sometimes I think part of the mistake that we're making is we're not adequately teaching children how to be emotionally intelligent. And so they grow up just thinking, oh, I'm supposed to add this to my plate. Now I'm supposed to add this to my plate. I'm supposed to stuff my feelings down. I'm not supposed to show that this is getting to me.
Mm-hmm.
So if you arrive at adulthood and you have not successfully negotiated the essential developmental milestones of your emotions, you're going to be in big trouble because you may not even know how stressed out you are.
So we need, as parents, to be working with our kids, teaching them this, giving them
absolutely.
Opportunities. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I'll give you, the little kid cries, and the mom says, you know how you used to say to little kids, pick it up, dust it off. You know, that's mm-hmm. the way of telling little kids, this is kind of a minor problem. But when a kid, you know, grabs a knife by the blade and cuts their hand open, that's a big problem, and that needs to be acknowledged. If little kids don't figure out what's little and what's big, then either everything is a big deal, and we have just birthed a whole generation of drama queens and kings, or nothing is a big deal, and we have just birthed a whole generation of kids who are out of touch with their emotions. They're shut down, they're plugged into their iPods or their video games, and they're not engaging even with their own emotions, let alone the emotions of others.
And is it the second group that you think are more susceptible to living life in this pace, this fast pace with all this, you know, and not noticing that they're, okay.
Yeah. So once you raise children who have emotional intelligence and you're in touch with your own emotional intelligence, being self-aware, being empathetic, understanding the feelings of others, being able to take good risks and organize yourself and understand, you know, how to manage yourself, well, then you got half the battle done. Because your kids will tell you, you know what, Mom, we're doing too much.
Mm-hmm.
Or they'll say, I'm sick of soccer, you know, and six other things at the same time. Or I don't want to play in the end-of-season specialty sports teams.
Right. Now, I do think sometimes that children want to do a lot.
Oh, right.
But then the results come out in other ways, maybe more indirect ways.
Sure. There's been some research done, and it was just reported a couple weeks ago from a study at Yale, that kids really, the more active activity, the better for kids. Now, there was a psychologist sitting on the couch along with the fellow who was reporting the results, and she was shaking her head, and she said, I think you better qualify what you mean by activity,
mm-hmm.
because busy work and busyness isn't necessarily good.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what the psychologist was saying was that, yeah, a lot of activity can be good for children as long as it's varied activity. You know, a child who sits and reads is getting some contemplative time. Then the child who goes out and plays with others is getting some physical and social time. It's really about a balance of activity.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put your kids in five sports at one time, they're getting an overload of that kind of activity and not enough of the other.
It reminds me of how we're supposed to eat, what healthy eating is.
Right, that's right.
Eating a
that's
lot of right. different varied foods.
Right.
I remember hearing you say something about put the alternative in front of them. What does it look like for a person who is taking the, you know, a good amount of leisure time? What does that day or life look like?
Oh, I'll tell you what. I think it starts before you can even see the leisure piece. It starts with minimizing the worry in your life, living within your means financially whenever you can, living simply enough that your life isn't overcomplicated with stuff, the care of stuff, the acquisition of stuff, the management of your stuff, mm-hmm. all that. It's being available to yourself and to others. So if you've got those pieces in place first, then you can go to the next thing, which is what can I do or not do, because G.K. Chesterton said there's the freedom to do something, that there's the freedom to do anything, and then there's the freedom to do nothing. So we need to understand that the ideal leisure, to me, combination of leisure and work, starts with, again, structuring your environment so that it doesn't add extra stress to your life, meaning affording the place that you live, living in a place that is not too stressful, ordering your environment so that it's nice to come home to at the end of the day and restful and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I had, I've had two children expecting a third, and I was living in a 900-square-foot apartment for 7 years, my husband and I, because we were trying to save up for a down payment. But I made sure that I tried to do with that little bit of a space what I could so that it wasn't a zoo, And I didn't want to spend all my time cleaning either.
Right.
So you start making decisions about the environment. Then once you get that kind of okay, then you start saying, now, what do I want to do? I want to do some things that meet my spiritual needs, my physical needs, my social needs, my intellectual needs. Because if I don't attend to those, I don't have anything to give to my kids and my family.
This is where I start getting overwhelmed, because I do think about, I want to do all of those things.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, sometimes just knowing that you will get to do them one day helps you delay the gratification. I used to hang a poem on my bedroom wall that said, to my child, you are the pearls I cannot buy. You are my blue Italian lake. You are my piece of foreign sky. Something like that, Okay, so I had a lot of kids. I loved having a lot of kids. It was great fun. But I knew that someday I'd get to travel.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started very early on thinking of the places I wanted to go. And I was willing to put that part of my life off while I took care of these kids. We didn't have any family locally to help us. So I knew I was going to be intensively involved in parenting and all that with my husband. But I knew that someday I'd get to travel. And once I launched my last kid off into college, I started thinking about, where can we go? It doesn't even have to be far, so that we can see something new and experience something new.
So when you're talking about balance in your life, it doesn't necessarily mean within one day or one week or even that year. It may be over time.
Over time, that's right. And I think, again, a lot of this is attitudinal, but I know that I may not get to go and run, or I may not get to go do the thing that I really want to do for several days, but if I'm working toward it, I'm going to get there. It's when we don't have anything we're looking forward to, anything that we're doing that gives meaning, and anything that we're looking back on that makes meaning of our lives, that we're getting trouble.
Right.
So I would like to tell you that every day of my life, I do some physical things, I do some spiritual things. My ideal day is this. I get up when I wake up, and I try to wake up naturally without an alarm if I can. For me, that's early. Then I go walk my dog. Sometimes it's in the dark. I walk my dog, walk around the block, around the neighborhood. Then I come home, and I have a little spiritual time for myself. Might do some reading or whatever. I try to answer my emails, my student emails, so that I don't walk into work already overwhelmed. And then I eat breakfast, and I try to get a balanced breakfast, and then I go to work. And then I do what I have to do. I teach, and I see students and things like that. And then I try not to take home with me stuff that I don't like grading tests or things like that are monotonous. I try to only take home with me the things that energize me, thinking about new ideas, being creative, because I know that the studies tell us that most of our creative ideas come when we're at leisure, not when we're sitting at a desk trying to say to ourselves, I need to produce something really good here. What's it going to be? It's when we disengage that we start unlocking the creative capacities that we have. So part of this is finding out what your preferences are and what your other family members' preferences are, offloading the stuff you don't like or trading it out with somebody else. If you said to my husband, okay, here's the deal, this weekend you need to fix these four things, ooh, he would just hate that. I would love it. So we swap out.
Right.
And brother, that's when having a partner or a spouse or kids who will share it up with you really helps.
Right.
If you're by yourself, my advice is to try to assign things to times so that they don't encroach on your free time.
Right.
Where now you're ending up in a competition with yourself. Okay, I got an hour. Now do I do the four things on the errand list, or do I go do something fun? Well, even if you go do something fun, the four things on your errand list are still hanging over your head.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's hard to even enjoy the hour that you have for fun.
Right. But it has helped me to think in terms of there will always be a list waiting there for me.
Yes, that's right.
And
that's
unless
right.
it's really urgent, choosing the fun is something I need to fill me up every day.
No question about it. And let me just say this, because I work with people who are dying. In my free time, I make videotapes with people who are dying.
Mm-hmm.
And I promise you, I haven't met one yet who said, I wish I'd gone to the office more.
Right.
When they sit down and make that tape for their kids, like women who have cancer, I sometimes videotape with them, and they make those tapes for their kids, the stuff that they remember are those times that are hard to make happen, but they're really important times. Then going to the store and all that stuff falls away. I also do drawings with children who have life-threatening illness. And when I say to a kid, draw me a picture of your family doing something together. This is a kid who's maybe got a terminal illness. They don't draw anything related to the stuff that we think of as on the list, on the to-do list. They draw going to the park together, going to the beach, you know, mm-hmm. playing at the playground. That's what they draw.
Right. You know, I hear this, I've heard this so much, and that when you work with someone who's dying, it really is highlighting what's most important to all of us. And I wonder if that's the only way to be really aware of what's most important is being, because those touches that with death really seem to bring it to the surface and make it so clear.
We have enough, I think, death around us that we have no excuse for not having a moment-by-moment reality check. But we get desensitized to it, and we don't look. But even my own mother-in-law said to me right after I got married, she said, my advice to you is live every day with your spouse as if it's your last, and you won't have any regrets. And that's why carving out that little bit of time in the morning to become self-aware, to get your head on straight, and to say to yourself, you know, please let me be tuned in enough so that when those wonderful moments come, I can see them for what they are. And I can seize those moments and make the most out of them.
Mm.
Any parent who's ever watched their kids sit around and reminisce knows that their experience of time is very different from yours.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff that they remember isn't often the stuff that you remember as wonderful and memorable. And that's why I think we need to periodically check in with our kids and say, you know, are we doing the things that really will make you look back on your life and say, wow, that was great. It was so much fun. We did fun stuff. Now, I was with a friend of mine when she died on the 1st of July. She died in her daughter's arms. Her daughter was 30 years old. And before she died, my friend and I had a chance to talk a lot about things. And when she started talking on the videotape about some of the fun things that she had done with her daughter, I was just overwhelmed with what I had missed. She said, hey, Elizabeth, remember how I used to come and check you out of school every St. Patrick's Day, and we'd just go take a mental health day and do fun things? And I'm sitting there thinking, I never did that.
Mm-hmm.
She said, remember when we would go to the beach and we'd just take off, and we wouldn't even know where we were going to stay? It didn't matter if it was in our car or in a wonderful hotel. We'd make it an adventure. And I sat there and behind that camera, and I said to myself, oh, my God, I should have been making life more of an adventure.
Because
that's the stuff kids remember.
Mm-hmm.
When you turn it into an adventure.
Thank you so much, Kathy, for speaking with us today about trying to create more leisure time in our lives.
Oh, I just hope your audience goes home and says, today is the first day of the rest of our lives together. We're going to do this better, and we're going to have fun.
Thanks for joining us for It's About Time. We always welcome your comments and your story ideas. You can email them to itsabouttimeradio@comcast.net. This show has been produced in association with Take Back Your Time, a national initiative challenging overwork, overscheduling, and time urgency. Their website is timeday.org.
He'd grown up just like me. My boy was just like me.